So the title is pretty much, you just said it. And for those of you who know a lot about the MSSM, my subtitle is, when does the minimal supersymmetric standard model really act like a two Higgs doublet model? And since most of you probably know it is a two Higgs doublet model, you probably think this is a mad question to ask. Hopefully by the end of the talk, you won't think it's so crazy. And this is based on sort of philosophically on some work I did with Babu, Marsh, Russell, and Wilczek, but mostly based on papers I've written in the last year or so with K.S. Babu of Oklahoma State. I'm going to start with the simplest thing, which is the supersymmetric Higgs vector. I'm going to remind you just very quickly how it's different from the standard model. Of course, the most important thing, the thing that makes this, the thing that defines sort of the minimal supersymmetric standard model at zeroth order, is take the standard model and for every state, every Higgs or fermion, turn it into a chiral multiplet and turn the vector bosons into vector multiplets, and that's basically the MSSM. And it's sort of very attractive in that sense because it gets rid of this strange differentiation between the scalars, which we introduced in the standard model in a very ad hoc way, and the fermions, which we know are there for the matter. In fact, the Higgs itself is just like any other chiral multiplet, just like the matter multiplets. The only difference is that in the standard model, it's the lepton that's the spin 1/2 state, like leptons and quarks that are important, whereas in the standard model, it's the spin 0 part of the Higgs multiplet that's important to us. Now, the only complication that arises is that because for the Higgs there is now a fermionic component, you have to have two of them because they contribute to anomalies. The simplest way to cancel these anomalies is just to put in a second Higgs doublet with opposite hypercharge from the first. And therefore, the MSSM is a two Higgs doublet model. And this is a very old and very wide class of models that are well studied. Luckily, putting in the second Higgs doublet is exactly what we need. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to give masses to all quarks and leptons. Holomorphy in supersymmetry tells us that we can't couple the same Higgs to both up quarks and down quarks to give them mass. Therefore, we need two in any case. So from the rest of this talk, there will be one Higgs H up, which couples up quarks and gives them mass, and one Higgs H down, which couples the down quarks and leptons and gives them mass. There is also now a new allowed interaction, the so-called mu parameter, which couples H up and H down. And then, because of the supersymmetric model, there's not much freedom apart from just adding soft breaking terms. So things like the potential are completely determined for me. So here's the potential of the Higgs vector. Mass terms for the down Higgses, mass terms for the up Higgses, a soft mass term that mixes them, and then quartic terms that are completely determined by supersymmetry and are given by gauge couplings. How many there? Well, depending on how you count, we know the gauge couplings, so you could say there are three here, three mass terms. Before adding the soft supersymmetry breaking, there are no new parameters. There's mu. Sorry. We'll get to accounting them in just a few minutes. Well, since there are two Higgs doublets, that means there are eight real fields. We still have to break SU2 cross U1 down to U1, so three of them will be goldstones that are eaten, and the rest will be physical. And in some sense, you can divide these into groups. There's this little h, as it's usually called, which is the lightest of the scalar Higgses, which in many limits of the model acts just like the standard model Higgs, more or less. And then there is essentially a complete SU2 doublet of Higgses, whose masses typically are close together. And in many ways, this is just like adding a second doublet right in, and here it is. If I just take the neutral component of the potential, then here are the three mass terms, here's the D term, quartic term, I can actually solve for the sum of the squares of the VEVs and the ratio of the VEVs of these two Higgses. The sum of the squares of the VEVs, of course, I have to set equal to the Z mass. This tells me something about the various masses. And of course, the ratio of the VEVs is completely unknown. And this is a parameter tan beta, which will play a key role in this talk. Now, most of the time, when I or most people who think about the MSSM talk about it and think about it, we like to think of it this way. You start with a standard model at the weak scale, you supersymmetrize it, and you add a second Higgs doublet at the supersymmetric scale. So in this sense, the low-energy effective theory of the MSSM is the standard model, which is a one Higgs doublet model. And in many limits of supersymmetry, this is a perfectly acceptable way to think of things. Well, that could be anything. Hopefully under a TV. From naturalness constraints, at least. However, there are some limits where this is not a very good description, and it'd be much more fair to start with a two Higgs doublet standard model and supersymmetrize it. And in fact, you can sort of see this. There's the scale MW, which sets the weak scale, the minimal standard model. There's a scale, which you'll see in a minute, is set by the mass of the pseudoscalar Higgs, I'll just call MA, which sets the mass scale of the second Higgs doublet. And then there is MSUSY, the mass of the superpartners. And in principle, these could be very different mass scales. So the low energy effective theory of the MSSM may not be the standard model, but it may be a two Higgs doublet standard model. And in that sense, the physics would be very different from what we expect in a one Higgs doublet standard model. Now, two Higgs doublet standard models have been known for a long time. I'll tell you a few things that are true in them, or at least possible. In a two Higgs doublet standard model, some of the so-called Higgs particles don't couple to fermions proportional to their mass. And because they don't couple with proportional to mass, neutral Higgs bosons can have flavor-changing couplings. So you get flavor-changing neutral currents. They can also have CP-violating couplings. These can have phases that you can't eliminate. And this is very easy to see. I mean, the simplest sort of extreme model is just imagine I have two Higgses. One gets a VeV, one doesn't. Couple them to some fermions, let's say the down quarks, like this, with some 3x3 matrix Y and Z. But this D here represents the column of down quark, strange quark, and bottom quark. Now, I want to go to the mass eigenstates. The mass is coming entirely from this term, so I diagonalize this. But, of course, the coupling now of H2 is completely non-diagonal, and therefore can generate H2 now can couple to, for example, a bottom and a strange simultaneously. So, in general, because they're not related, these couplings are not necessarily related masses, they can generate flavor-changing recurrence and CP violation. Now, the solution to this problem has been known every bit as long as the problem itself. We can make a respectable two Higgs doublet standard model by segregating the up and down sectors. That is, we only allow one of the Higgses to couple to the up quarks and one of the Higgses to couple to the down quarks in such a way that after they both get VeVs, the sum of their squares is the appropriate value to give, explain the W mass. Because they couple one only to each type, the couplings are proportional to mass. You get no Higgs-mediated flavor change of recurrence, and there's no Higgs-mediated CP violation. And these last two statements are true even after the H up and H down mix into their mass eigenstates, because these aren't necessarily mass eigenstates either, but these still hold true. The question is, what keeps this very nice Higgs doublet model from becoming a very bad one like this one, where I start putting in couplings of an H down star to up quarks or an H up star to down quarks? What prevents it is a simple Z2 symmetry here. It's easy to see. If I just let the right-handed up quarks and H up be odd and everything else be even, there's no way to generate this Lagrangian. Now, what happens when I supersymmetrize this? Well, here's the superpotential in the MSSM. It's a two Higgs doublet standard model, so the respectable sort. But it's also got this mu parameter coupled with H up and H down. Now, the mu parameter here has to be non-zero. Otherwise, we would have seen basically an RX xeno in our spectrum and our colliders already. And since we haven't seen a light fermion in our colliders that plays this role, then mu has to be non-zero. And if mu is non-zero, that Z2 symmetry I told you about a moment ago is broken. Now, that's not a problem, because the Z2 symmetry in the MSSM can be replaced by holomorphy, or just the non-renormalization theorem. It tells us that once we have this, we're going to keep it. The problem is, what happens when supersymmetry is broken? The Z2 is broken, and supersymmetry is broken. Doesn't seem to be anything left to protect us from the dangerous couplings.
What is the estimate of the value of mu?
Well, naturalness tells us it has to be something under a TeV. But I think you could probably put lower bounds on it, probably in the 30 to 40 GeV range. I wouldn't know the exact number. Oh, I just showed that. All right, so this is the type of transparency everyone's seen a million times. This is just to remind you of mostly notation. What do we mean by broken supersymmetry? The way we do it, whether it's going to be spontaneous or put in by hand, is we write down a so-called softly broken model, which we add all possible mass terms. These include mass matrices for the squarks and sleptons, explicit masses for the Higgses, masses for the Gaginos. This is the Gluino, for example, playing an important role. Trilinear soft terms that look a lot like Yukawa couplings in the superpotential. Matter of fact, I've made a choice here to write all these trilinear terms as proportional to the Yukawa matrices. This isn't the way it has to be, but this is actually a very conservative choice. And then there's the soft term that mixes H up and H down. Now, before I put in all these soft terms, there are essentially only, there are no net new parameters in the MSSM over the standard model. The mu parameter is new, but the arbitrary quartic coupling and Higgs potential that we don't know in the standard model goes away. Here, we now have 105 new parameters. These include quite a few mixing angles and 43 new CP violating phases. Now, you recall in the standard model we have two, only one of which probably plays an important role, being the delta in the CKM matrix. Now, the MSSM is a really general effective theory is a disaster. If you just write down the MSSM and start throwing numbers into it and say, this is my effective theory, I'm just going to put order one things in, it's awful. It can be ruled out, and it could be ruled out, you know, decades ago based on kaon physics. So we know there has to be some order to this to get rid of, for example, the large flavor changing that comes up or the large CP violation. I'm not going to discuss that at length, but I'll just say the simplest thing that one can do is simply to decide that all the squarks are mass degenerate. All the squarks are the same flavor. All the squarks in the same quantum numbers are mass degenerate. This gets rid of all the big sources of flavor changing, also gets rid of most of the big sources of CP violation. And I'm going to take that as my assumption for this talk, just because if I go away from this, I just get bigger effects. So I'll emphasize that when I show you flavor changing in this talk or CP violation, it has nothing to do with the fact that I've got non-degenerate squarks or sleptons. All right, so we're almost done with defining the Higgs sector.
So everything will be generated by
Yukawa? Yes. Yeah. It's all going to come from Yukawa's. There's one exception I'll show you that could show have some mass non-degeneracy, but it's not necessary. It doesn't have to be there. Okay, so now this is all just definitions. The scalars, they're two physical scalars, which are generated from the Higgs up and Higgs down by some rotation angle alpha. There's the pseudo-scalar, which is the partner of the, which mixes with the neutral goldstone with some angle beta, and same thing in the charge sector. The masses of the various Higgses can be written down in very simple forms. Particularly, the charged Higgs mass is determined by the pseudo-scalar mass, more or less. The light Higgs mass and the light scalar and the heavy scalar get their masses like this. Essentially, well, what one finds in this is the light Higgs, of course, has to very famously be less than the Z mass, and the heavier of the scalar's mass is also pretty much determined by MA. Now, the angles alpha and beta are correlated to the masses, so there are relations we can write down. And we can also write down the couplings of each of these Higgs to particles in the standard model relative to the coupling of the standard model Higgs. And these are just trig functions. There's nothing special going on here. I want to point out that the bottom and tau have exactly the same couplings to the Higgses, relative to the standard model. The most interesting thing about this is that there's a certain limit, the Higgs decoupling limit, in which this all simplifies greatly. Which is if I take the pseudoscalar mass to infinity, then right along with it go the charged Higgs and the second scalar Higgs. So the second Higgs double has basically gone away. If you put that into these formulas, you'll find that alpha goes to beta minus pi over 2. And then putting that into each of these, you'll find that H naught, this is a 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. And then these, of course, are not necessarily 1, but I've just decoupled them from the theory, so I don't really care. Which is to say that MA really controls how much this looks like a one Higgs doublet model versus a two Higgs doublet model. And then the limit when it gets very big this little H really is the standard model Higgs, and this second Higgs doublet, the capital H A and charged Higgs really form a second Higgs doublet completely independently. So there are sort of four very important tree-level results in the MSSM. The first one is probably the most famous of all of them, which is that the light Higgs is light. We know at tree level it has to have a mass below the Z, and once one puts in one loop corrections, that goes up to somewhere around 130 GeV. And this is one of the great predictions of the MSSM that can be tested. The others are less well known, but actually they're very important for once one finds a Higgs and determining whether or not one's looking at an MSSM Higgs. For example, the neutral Higgs bosons in the MSSM couple in a flavor diagonal way. So there are no Higgs-mediated flavor change neutral currents. There are certain ratios of Higgs couplings which are invariant when one goes from the standard model to the MSSM. So for example, if one measures the rate at which Higgs goes to B versus the rate goes, Higgs go to tau, this ratio is the same in the standard model in the MSSM. And there is no CP violation in the neutral Higgs sector. Now, Levakun took a poll yesterday, and I took a very informal poll this morning of about four people and asked them if they could define a flavor change neutral current and what it was important for. And actually, they did much better than I expected. But I still thought I'd better explain why these are particularly important for those who don't do this for a living. Flavor change neutral currents in the standard model are very small. At tree level, you processes like a bottom quark going to a strange quark through a Z, a photon, or a Higgs to a pair of leptons is just zero. Unitarity of the rotation matrices that go between the various generations guarantees this. At one loop, you would think it'd be generated, of course, but when you sum over all states, all virtual states, you find that most of it cancels out and there's just a small bit left over. So this is the Gym mechanism work. And even though this is a one-loop diagram, the Gym mechanism forces this to be small enough that it's more like having an extra loop worth of suppression. So sort of numerically, these loop diagrams are more like two loop. So in this way, when you start putting new physics into the model, looking at flavor change neutral currents is a great place because you have some hope of competing. I mean, the standard model gives you such small numbers that new physics might actually compete with them. So you make up in... then the other thing is that because oftentimes, for example, this is a B meson, oftentimes these are light mesons you're looking at, and light meson decays. You can make up in quantity what we lack in energy. So you can produce a lot of kaons or a lot of B mesons and then study their decays. I mean, the sort of numbers we're talking about, I mean, look at this. This is just recently, this has been measured, the branching ratio of a charged kaon to pi plus nu nu at the 10 to the minus 10 level. So this is the kind of precision physics we're talking about. And 10 to the minus 10, now this is a number you can actually imagine new physics coming in and affecting. This could have become 10 to the minus 9. You see the various other flavor-changing parameters here. This one will become important later. The branching ratio of B to mu to a pair of muons is about 10 to the minus 6 level. This is going to increase by about two orders of magnitude in the very near future. All right, so that's why flavor-changing currents are important. And especially lacking an LHC right now, they're one of the best ways to go after new physics. So here's one transparency of history that will lead up to the results I'm going to present. Back in 94, when everybody was in the middle of the SUSY gut frenzy of trying to figure out whether or not unification worked and what we could learn from it, Halvard, Tati, and Sarid were looking at mass relations that came out of guts. For example, in SU5, the bottom tau mass relation, or the one that occurs in SO10, where bottom tau and top are all the same. But of course, these are relations at the gut scale. And then they said, well, are these relationships true in the standard, in the MSSM? Are they true based on what we observe at the weak scale? Well, there are two things you have to do to go from these predictions at the gut scale down to observations at the low scale. One is you solve your normalization group equations. This is, I'll call it model independent, only because everyone uses the same model, which is the Grand Desert. And then you have to match onto the physics at the weak scale. This is a much more model dependent process. Now, everyone was doing number one here. And what they were finding is that except in very small parts of supersymmetric parameter space, unification, for example, B tau or B tau top, was failing by 20% or more. So this was considered something bad for guts. What these three realized is that the threshold corrections of the weak scale could be huge. It could easily be 20%. And the way you see this is take a look at a bottom quark. Now, usually you get this mass just by coupling to the downside Higgs. But through this sort of loop diagram, actually, you can couple a bottom quark to an up-type Higgs. Now, this is the exact kind of dangerous coupling I was talking about earlier, where I'm coupling down quarks to up Higgses. Now, in principle, these are loop diagrams. They'd be very small, certainly not going to present 20% effects. But when I write down what the bottom mass is coming out of this, well, here's the tree level piece. Here is essentially products of the factors that show up in this loop. Various supersymmetric masses, the gluino mass, mu, over squark masses. Essentially, the stuff in parentheses is order 1. There's no reason for this to be very small. The 1 over 16 pi squared is what you expect for a loop, and this is why you think this is going to be small to begin with. But the tan beta is a surprise. Tan beta represents the ratio between the up Higgs VeV to the down Higgs VeV. If for some reason the up Higgs VeV is anomalously large compared to the down Higgs VeV, then this ratio could also be, order 1. So large tan beta can offset the fact that there's a loop suppression here. And in fact, what I mean by large and very realistic tan betas in MSSM are something like 30 to 70. So put 30 to 70 somewhere in this, and this can easily be 20%. So they concluded that, you know, B tau top unification may not be so bad. They also told us the bad news, that you'd have to know a lot about the SUSY spectrum at the low scale in order to really say anything. The other interesting point about this, of course, is that if I take all these supersymmetric mass parameters here, the gluino mass, the mu, and the mu parameter, and like the squark masses, and take them all to infinity together, this doesn't change. This doesn't decouple. This is a non-decoupling effect. So even at very large supersymmetric mass scales, this could be very important. I should point out that this has exactly the structure you'd expect from the arguments I made about the two Higgs doublet model. I said that there was a Z2 symmetry that was broken by the mu parameter, so that the mu parameter has to be in here to break that Z2. And I said supersymmetry then had to be broken as well, and that's why you had the gluino mass in the A terms. So this is exactly what you'd expect to break the symmetries that prevented these sort of couplings. All right, so are there any tests of these ideas? I mean, in principle, this is very nice, but those loops had a lot of different supersymmetric mass parameters in them, some of which aren't the easiest to actually go out and measure. In order to check this, do we actually have to measure all those and then just compare it to a calculation? Well, the answer is that we can't avoid this. There is a real test. And the reason is that these finite threshold effects do create the dangerous two Higgs doublet standard model couplings. And because they create these dangerous couplings, the couplings will no longer be proportional simply to mass. Neutral Higgses can mediate flavor changing, and neutral Higgses can mediate CP violating processes. Of course, the caveat in all this is that we know that at the same time, as we take the pseudoscalar mass very large, all these effects have to vanish. Because the limit in which I take the pseudoscalar mass large is the limit in which this is a one Higgs doublet model. And in a one Higgs doublet model, none of this can happen. So you know these things are going to fall off for large pseudoscalar masses. And this is exactly the Higgs decoupling limit. So the results I'll talk about today sort of rely partially on having pseudoscalars that aren't too heavy. But you'll see as I get to real numbers that real heavy 600, 700 GeV pseudoscalars may be light enough to do what we need. All right, so the following two transparencies are probably the most important in the entire talk. And if you understand these, then you've got it all, because everything else is just a variation on a theme. Let's begin by writing down an effective Lagrangian and some interaction eigenbasis. All right, so here's our Lagrangian. These are the fermions. These are three vectors. Here are Yukawa matrices, the down-type Yukawa matrix, the up-type Yukawa matrix. Of course, I'm only writing the effective Lagrangian for the down quarks. Now, here is the tree-level mass term for the down quarks. This term that has the epsilon g here represents the correction coming from this particular diagram. So let's look at this diagram. You've got left-handed quarks come in, right-handed going out. This is a mass term when you give a VeV to H up. There's a strong coupling here, and the Y, the down-type Yukawa matrix right there. So it has the exact same Yukawa form as this. There's a YD here, there's a YD there. So it looks just like the tree level, except that it's got some loop type correction. So this is essentially a one loop correction to this operator, except it's got the H up star. And this is typically a one loop thing. This quantity here you expect to be something of order one, and this is suppressed by a loop. More importantly is this diagram. This diagram, instead of exchanging a Gluino, you exchange Higgs-Enos. And the couplings now involve the Yukawa matrices of the up-type quarks. So here you have Y up, another Y up at the top, and Y down. So this has a very different structure in terms of flavor. Of course, it's still suppressed by something that looks like one loop. Finally, you actually can get from this diagram something that looks like it has the same flavor structure as this. And it simply comes from the fact that the squark that goes in here can mix with other squarks. And this is where I said if I allow some bit of non-universality in the squark masses, I could get a little bit of extra effect. For example, you know, the toy model everyone uses is set all the squark masses to be degenerate at some very high scale and then run them down to the weak scale. Well, here is the most important part of the RGE for these. And you see that there is a flavor structure, a non-trivial flavor structure, to the running of the squark masses. So the squark masses at the weak scale have some universal piece, so some correction proportional to Y dagger Y for up quarks and down quarks. And you can actually, then you can calculate how much of epsilon U comes from this sort of running. And it's basically a third times C, this coefficient here, times the size of epsilon G, which is the underlying operator. Now, all right, so here's some numbers. Actually, they're not completely numbers yet, but if I assume sort of universalist Susi breaking, this diagram is about four times smaller than this diagram. So this is down by a quarter, but we don't know its sign or phase. Notice that these two diagrams are generated even if I have completely universal scalar masses at the weak scale. I mean, there's nothing here about non-universal scalar masses. Gym mechanism does nothing to cancel these off. This one, of course, is generated if there is some little bit of non-universality. But, of course, and it could be very important if, for example, you tell me that the model has anomalously small A terms. But in any case, the point being here that we have two contributions to epsilon mu, which have roughly the same size in comparison to one another. Notice this third epsilon g, and this is about a quarter epsilon g, and c is sort of in this range of minus one to minus a quarter. So those could both be very important to what we're doing. But then, all right, go to the mass basis. So we're going to diagonalize this as much as we possibly can. First, we diagonalize the up quarks separately. We diagonalize the up quarks and get rid of them. Then trying to diagonalize the down quarks as much as we can introduces a CKM matrix. And I want to write the sort of zeroth order CKM matrix as V naught here. And the reason is V naught will be clear in a moment. And what you see when you look at this is that this is diagonal in the same basis that the Gluino loop contributions were, but not that the Higgs-Eno loop contributions were. So if this were zero, if epsilon u were zero, we could diagonalize this, we'd be done. There'd be nothing interesting to say. However, this being non-zero upsets it. And the easiest way to do this is simply to throw out all Yukawa couplings except of the third generation. So I'm just going to keep the top and bottom Yukawa coupling. And then this flavor-conserving piece, well, let's forget the 1 plus epsilon g out in front, but the d times v naught dagger has a matrix form that looks like this, where the flavor-violating piece, the epsilon u, looks like this. So clearly they're not diagonal on the same basis. Now, the real CKM matrix, not this sort of zeroth order approximation, the real CKM matrix has to diagonalize the down quark mass matrix. Now, the mass matrix has this form. Notice that it's just taking this up here and putting tan beta in where H up is. When I diagonalize it, I find that the bottom Yukawa coupling has shifted. If you take the physical Yukawa coupling, the one that actually determines the B mass, it's shifted from the sort of ultraviolet Yukawa coupling by some finite threshold correction, which is loop factors times tan beta. And this is exactly the result that Horvatazzi and Sarid got in 94. So this is their equation. Similarly, you can ask how much did the CKM element shift? And they shift from their zeroth order amount by something that looks like this. Notice that, once again, if epsilon u is zero, the pain in brackets is one. So there's no new effect in that limit. All right. It's the same thing is true if I put in VCB or VTD or VTS. So several of the terms in the CKM matrix get these corrections. However, things like VTB receive no correction at this order. Now, the important thing to notice, of course, is that from the point of Horvatazzi and Sarid, they don't care about epsilon u because they get everything they need from epsilon g. This alone shifts the bottom mass. But you need to have this epsilon u in order to shift the CKM elements. Actually, Stuart Robbie and all have actually studied what these corrections do to gut models. And in some cases, they claim it does help. But, of course, it's highly model-dependent. So I should have pointed out, actually, that this formula, well, this was derived by Horvatazzi and Sarid, this was derived by Robbie and company. But then that was it. No one went any farther with this stuff. So here's my effective neutral current Lagrange. Now I'm just looking at the neutral components of the Higgses in the down sector. I'm just rewriting this over and over again. I'm going to do all the matrix multiplications out using the simplified matrices, just keeping the bottom and top Yukawa couplings. And here is my flavored chain neutral current Lagrangian. Notice that I've got couplings here that couple a right-handed bottom to a left-handed down, or a right-handed bottom to a left-handed strange. They go like elements of the CKM matrix. They go like the bottom quark Yukawa coupling. And they go like some flavor-changing parameter chi, which is this mess. Now, mess isn't so important. What's important is that it's proportional to epsilon u, and that the denominator sort of is close to 1, and the top is a loop factor times tan beta. So once again, this guy is easily order 1. Matter of fact, if you just put in sort of sample models, you get something that's of order of fifth to a half for the chi. Now all I have to do now is go to the Higgs mass eigenbasis. So the three mass eigenstates, here they're basically their Feynman rules. The coupling for a light Higgs to B right down left goes like cosine beta minus alpha. But heavier Higgs sine beta minus alpha in the pseudoscalar 1 times this quantity here. And I can do the same thing where I replace the downs with stranges by just replacing VTD with VTS. The decoupling limit works here. If I take MA to infinity, cosine beta minus alpha goes to 0. So it says that in the large MA limit, this coupling goes away. These couplings don't go away, but once again, that doesn't matter. They don't have to. Now, where do we expect to see this stuff? Well, usually, when I tell you there's a new flavor changing effect, it's the mixing of, for example, BB bar or KK bar. That's the strongest place, the best place to go looking. These are very well, BB bar is not so well measured yet, but KK bar, for example, very well measured. You'll see in the next few transparencies that for this type of flavor changing, this is almost zero. So there's almost no prediction. There's almost no effect on BB bar mixing. This is actually good news because then it allows us to go to other processes and ask how big it is. And I'm going to focus on B going to paramuons. And, of course, some things you can also measure, like, for example, say, B going to some strange matter and neutrinos just doesn't happen because these are Higgses, after all, and they don't couple to neutrinos. So BB bar mixing, I just have two quick transparencies since the result basically here is null. You can imagine getting BB bar mixing from a diagram looks like this. Here's the flavor-changing vertex. Coupling a B to either a down or a strange. Here's another flavor-changing vertex here, and I'm exchanging all three different types of Higgses. Well, here is the shift in the bottom, the BD mass that would indicate that there was mixing. The problem is it's proportional to this factor F, which is basically the sum over these propagators, and the sum over the propagators is zero. This seems very strange. As a matter of fact, when I first did this, I'd never seen this identity in the MSSM before, and I was quite surprised by it. Now, of course, this is only a tree-level effect. It's due to the fact that the coupling, the flavor-changing coupling of the bottom right to down left is proportional is to this interaction eigenstate. This is the interaction eigenstate that fuels the flavor-changing. This interaction eigenstate is essentially orthogonal to the standard model Higgs. And therefore, the Lagrangian you write down, the effect of Lagrangian, ends up having only interactions that change bottom quark number by either 0 or 1. And this changes it by 2. And unfortunately, if you try to build up from the effect of Lagrangian an interaction that changes bottom quark number by 2, you can't seem to do it. And this actually has to do with the fact that the quartic couplings in the MSSM are controlled by gauge couplings. So in a general Higgs doublet model, this isn't true. But the fact that quartic couplings are so well prescribed doesn't allow me to write delta B equals 2 type interactions.
This is formally a three-loop effect.
Yes. This is the biggest diagram that contributes to it. And this is 1, 2, 3 loops. And not surprisingly, even though two of the loops are anomalously large, I mean, these two loops are not big suppressions. Even so, you find that this is really small. And so given what we know about BD mixing, for very large tan betas, it's like tan beta 60 and 40, the best I could possibly hope to do is put limits on the pseudoscalar masses of between somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 GeV. And this is not a very useful range because there are lots of other experiments plus indirect measurements that tell us that the pseudoscalar mass is probably bigger than 100 GeV, especially at large tan beta. And even though BS mixing hasn't been studied yet, I can already tell you that it won't help. Nothing new can be learned from it.
Why don't you consider one loop diagrams? Aren't there one loop diagrams you can draw that have the same assertion?
They have too many Higgs.
No.
You're just talking non-Higgs. Yeah, sure. Yeah, the MSSM has one loop diagrams that contribute to DB bar mixing. Why aren't they bigger?
Yeah.
Well, it depends on what the masses of the various quarks and leptons are. In general, they can be.
But isn't the key that they're actually roughly the same size as that diagram right there? And the point is that that diagram is that the one of these transparency will not allow because of this funny cancellation. One of the previous diagrams,
if that were allowed, that would be the dominant.
Then it would be by far the dominant.
There are three loops. It's really only one loop in terms of numerically. I mean, this is tan beta over 16 pi squared. So this is essentially one here, and one over 16 pi squared here. I mean, of course, I'm taking the limit in which these are close to one. At low tan beta, these are also loop factors, so that really would be a three-loop diagram. I mean, the point of all this is that BB bar mixing doesn't tell as much for Higgs mediated. And this goes away in the decoupling limit, absolutely. Which is why you don't get very good limits on MA. This is one loop. This is the rare decay B to Muse. There really is one loop here, but this is that loop I said was anomalously large. So there are no small loop factors here. So this is just a B with a D or a B with an S, so BD or BS meson, going through Higgs to a pair of muons. Now, the small number here is the mass of the muon, because the Higgs has to couple to this. We know it couples like the mass. Now, I can calculate this. I don't get any strange cancellations. There's no reason I should. Here's the width for this. Of course, the bottom Yukawa is in here. The muon Yukawa coupling is in here. The appropriate elements of the CKM matrix are in here. Chi is in here. Experimentally, this has been measured, and this is measured at the Tevatron. To have branching ratios of less than either 7 or 20 times 10 to the minus 7, depending on whether you're doing the B sub D or the B sub S. Now, there's a relative factor of 3 in these because the Tevatron produces 3 times as many down BDs as they produce BSs. But because the width here goes like VTD squared or VTS squared, and that ratio is about 25, it's B sub S where they're going to see this. So they lose a factor of 3 in B sub S here, but they gain a factor of 25 here. So it's B sub S to a pair of muons that's going to where this would show up. All right, I'm going to put some sample numbers in. The epsilons I showed you earlier, something of order, like epsilon u is of order 1 over 320 for universal soft masses. And depending upon various signs that I can play with, I get, using current data, limits on MA of somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 GeV. So this is just sort of very rough, but it tells us that MA has to be greater than about 200 GeV just based on this. This is for the tan beta shown here. This seems like a strange sort, but I took sort of the maximum tan beta I could so that the bottom Yukawa coupling was no bigger than the top Yukawa coupling, which was my way of just parameterizing that the theory should stay perturbative. So the flavor changing, I just put in this these epsilons. 1 over 80 for epsilon G, 1 over 320 for epsilon U. Epsilon, the second contribution, the mixing contribution, I varied as either minus 3 quarters or 0 times epsilon G over 3. So I mean, this is a very standard number, right? This is just saying that mu, AT, the Guino mass, and M0, the squirt masses, are all the same.
So what's epsilon as the contribution?
Epsilon is the loop factor that multiplies tan beta over 16 pi squared. So epsilon times tan beta over 16 pi squared is basically the... Yes. To the effective Yukawa coupling. Now, these bounds are better, but they're still not fantastic. I really like too much better. I'd really like to be able to discover MA in this way. But the great thing about this process is that in the standard model, the branching ratio of BS to mu's is about 10 to the minus 9. Whereas... Did I show the branching ratio here? Oh, well, this is... All right, so this is... This is many times smaller than the current experimental range bound, which I just, on the last transparency, was 10 to the minus, about 10 to the minus 6, actually. This means, yeah, here I have it, it's 1,000 times smaller in current bounds. That means I can increase the pseudoscalar mass by a factor of 5 before I hit the standard model. 5 gives me up to a TeV. Now, it doesn't mean I'll actually experimentally get to there, but in fact, the truth is that LHC claims they will see this decay, which means LHC will, in fact, be measuring, could probe MA up to about a TeV. Now, let's hope LHC is not only seeing this. This is a puzzling footnote, I know. If you just look at the largest numbers in this, it's not C. Actually, I see C changed from minus 3 quarters to 0. What happened here is that the physical bottom Yukawa coupling is getting, the physical bottom quark mass is getting, for these two factors, a large negative contribution. Which means the bottom quark Yukawa coupling, the one that you actually, the ultraviolet one, is much bigger. And so I can only let tan beta get up to these values before it just becomes much, much bigger than 1, and the whole thing falls apart, and I can't do the calculation. So this is sort of the maximum tan beta I can allow for those cases.
Can I come back to the beta thing for a second?
Sure.
So you have this three loop diagram, and two of the loops are sort of have big couples.
Right.
So they're not quite exactly. But I still don't understand why I can't draw a one loop diagram that also has, which is anomalously large, two big box diagrams.
What do you want to have inside the box? Let me just ask that. The Higgs's or not? Oh, well, absolutely. No, there's no doubt that supersymmetric models can have one-loop diagrams.
If they're in the same operator, it will have the same enhancement function. So some things would call that, aside from the...
No, you mean the tan beta enhancement?
Yeah.
No, it won't have the tan beta enhancement. Because the tan beta is coming entirely from the fact that the masses of these quarks are mismatched from their Higgs coupling interaction eigenstates by something proportional to tan beta. The tan beta is coming from the Higgs itself.
So is this just some coupling? Never mind, some coupling you
want to go. No, it's not. It's not just. Right, let's. Maybe we should go back. All right, so here's the sort of tree level diagram. Now, what I'm saying is that, in fact, let me just go back to the Feynman rule. No. That's not entirely a true statement. Matter of fact, if you look here, I've written it as See, this is the bottom Yukawa coupling. Inside this chi is an epsilon times tan beta. Okay, so the epsilon is just a normal loop factor. There's nothing special there. There's a tan beta times the Yukawa coupling. Now, this Yukawa coupling itself is mb times tan beta. So if I wrote it in terms of physical masses, this would go to tan beta squared. That's a surprise here. I mean, it's not just that I'm absorbing the tan beta that's automatically in the masses and showing it to you and making a big deal out of it. There's actually an extra tan beta. The tan beta is coming from the fact that the Higgs masses know about tan beta, but the Higgs interaction eigenstates don't. And therefore, the rotation angle that goes from one to the other depends on tan beta, and it was proportional to tan beta. Trying to see how best to show that to you. Basically, this is the mass matrix. There's a tan beta in the mass matrix, of course, right? The interaction matrix that determines the interactions of the Higgs is the same thing, basically, without the tan beta, involving some rotations of the various Higgs among each other, among themselves. So there's some difference in the two bases that is determined by tan beta. So that's where this is coming from.
But the tan beta only appears in the mass matrix.
The tan beta here appears in the mass matrix. But then when I do the rotation, it shows up.
It would seem to suppress the effect by going over tan beta. Maybe we can talk about that.
All right. All right. So but let me just point out what can be done in the very near future. At run 2 of the Tevatron, just taking one inverse femtobarn of data, they can reach branching ratios about 10 to the minus 7. So this is a factor of 20 better than they can do right now. The bounds on MA can go up to the 400 GeV range, roughly. And after a few years, and they take 5 inverse femtobarns, we're talking about numbers close to 700 GeV. So even though the Tevatron cannot find supersymmetry if all the supersymmetric particles are sitting at 700 GeV, they still could find it through indirect detection of pseudoscalars in flavor-changing processes. Now, of course, seeing B going to mu mu doesn't tell you that you see supersymmetry. That's not proof of anything. But it is proof you've got new physics. And this is the kind of new physics that could do it. There are also secondary modes, like B going to some strange matter times mu mu, which are slightly weaker than this in terms of their reach, but comparable. And if you could do taus, you could really have very strong reach, but taus are extremely difficult to do. Now, everything I said here was about flavor changing. But you'll notice I also mentioned the fact that it shifted the Yukawa couplings themselves. So what is that going to do? Now, that's a talk in itself. I think I have about three transparencies here to summarize sort of the effect of just shifting the bottom quark Yukawa coupling. And the reason I don't emphasize this is because it's actually a relatively hard experiment to do, and it may require someday a Higgs factory, like a muon collider. I've already pointed out that certain ratios of branching ratios, or widths, are invariant when one goes from the standard model to the MSSM. So this ratio of Higgs to Bu bar and MSSM over Higgs to Bu bar in the standard model is the same as it is for taus. So I can define a ratio, RB tau, of ratios. It's the ratio of the branching ratio of Higgs goes to B over the branching ratio of Higgs goes to tau. Now, in the standard model, well, it's 3 times the bottom mass squared over the tau mass squared. This is typical. 3 is the color factor, of course. And there's a QCD and a phase space correction, which is of order 25% in brackets. Now, what happens at one loop? The kind of corrections I'm talking about here. Now, I've already showed you the bottom gets very large correction to its Yukawa. What about the tau? Well, here's the biggest diagram the bottom has. It has a gluino in it. The tau doesn't have color, so the tau is not going to know about this diagram. So that hurts it already. Here's the second largest diagram, actually the only other diagram I showed you, but it is the second largest. This has Higgsinos in it and stops running around. Now, if I was new to the tau, these would be right-handed neutrinos. Well, these don't exist either in the MSSM, so this diagram doesn't occur. So, to a very good approximation, the tau gets no particular correction to its Yukawa coupling. So, it's the same as it is in the standard model. Now, I wanted to show transparency, I guess I'm... Here it is. I can play the same game again, but now I'm taking flavor out of it. I mean, so this is actually much simpler, because there's no flavor to worry about. And I can just write some quantity epsilon d, which is just the sum now of the epsilon g and the epsilon u contributions. And I can write down the mass Lagrangian, and I can write down the coupling Lagrangian. I can, in terms of these, write rb tau, and here's what I get. Now, this is tree-level standard model. Here's the one-loop correction of the standard model, and here's the new piece that comes from supersymmetry. Now, this has a very strange look to it, but in the Higgs decoupling limit, this is just what we expect. The cosine alpha goes to minus tan beta, so this stuff here just goes to 1 again. So this is very nice. I can use, at large tan beta, some approximate formulas relating alpha to beta. Here's one that's useful. Then I can rewrite this rb tau as the standard model piece times the correction here. Now, it goes like mz squared over ma squared, so it decouples in large ma, as we expect. And it involves just this epsilon b times tan beta. Now, epsilon b times tan beta is the shift in the bottom quark mass. I mean, this is the shift that one got from these corrections. So this can completely be rewritten in terms of the shift in the bottom mass coming from these loop corrections. And, of course, the unknown pseudoscalar mass. Now, how big are such things? I can do two types of estimates. One is just simple. I put in, you know, the simplest numbers for universal masses. This tells me that delta MB over MB is like, you know, 1 over 60 to 1 over 100 times tan beta. So obviously in this range with tan beta 60 and this 1 over 64, you know, this is 1 to a half. I could also go to what we learned about grand unified theories many years back and ask how much do I need delta MB over MB to be to get guts to work, to get unification of Yukawa couplings. And the easiest thing to do there is just show this plot. This is tan beta versus the strong coupling in the standard model. At very large tan beta and very small tan beta, the theory can't really unify into a gut because it goes non-perturbative. In the little tiny black shaded areas, you actually get bottom tau or bottom tau top unification. But you see that in this whole sort of parameter space, it's a very small region in which you actually get the unification you wanted. And the rest of it, you're off by an amount I've shown here in contours, roughly about 20%. And you know the sign, of course. It's minus 20%. Now, I, to save time, won't show you all the equations. But I can plot how much this RB tau ratio differs from the standard model prediction as a function of the shift in the bottom mass versus the pseudoscalar mass. And I can also tell you where the guts would like this to sit. And of course, this box is where the guts would like to sit. So you see, if the pseudoscalar mass is 300, guts tell you somewhere between like 7 to 12%. If we're lucky and it's like 200, this could be a very large effect. But obviously, at very large pseudoscalar masses, this is only a few percent. Out here, this is probably never going to be observable. Down here, this could well be observable. The nice thing, though, that makes this much easier to do is if we ever do find the heavier Higgses, you can also measure their decays into bottoms and taus in the ratio. Now, this ratio should be 1 in the MSSM without loops. With loops, it varies greatly from 1. If I just look at the gut range, the gut tells me this ratio should vary by 1 by anywhere from, say, 50 to 70%. Or I guess that's an 80. 50 to 80%. So this is a very big effect that one could observe in the decays of these heavier Higgses, if you're actually able to measure these decays, which is not a given. So the logic is simple, that if you have a gut, you typically have to have some shift in the bottom mass of order minus 20%. This is going to suppress the decays of Higgses into taus. That's the result of all those numbers. If you actually see this pattern, then this is good evidence, or this is indirect evidence, that maybe the guts are on the right track. If not, if it's not there or goes the wrong way, then you really have to ask what's going on with guts. In that strange, very unusual way, Higgs branching ratios end up probing gut scale physics, which is something I don't think I ever expected to be true. Now, this goes back to that comment that Jim asked about my footnote. If epsilon g is negative, then that means delta mb over mb is negative, which is what we want for the guts. This is the same thing. So this is what the guts give you is the same thing that maximizes the Faber changing signal. So that's a little coincidence that might be useful someday. All right. So I promised in the title something about CP violation. So I this afternoon wrote two transparencies. Now, I told you in the beginning there are 43 new phases in the MSSM. If all those were order 1 and we just put the general MSSM in, it would be a disaster. We'd have CP violation all over the place. However, we know how to get rid of 41 of those phases. And that's simply by saying that the squarks and sleptons are degenerate with one another. And that essentially eliminates 41 physical phases from the picture. There are two left. Here they are. They're relative phases between A terms and gluino mass and B terms and U's and gluino mass. There are bounds that Scott Ashley, among other people, have derived that come from the neutron EDM that tells us that these have to be small or the squarks have to be bigger than about a TV. But this is not, I mean, compared to the other sorts of bounds when it gets to the MSSM, this is a relatively weak one. In the things I was doing, epsilon U actually has a phase. I mean, there's a mu star times A, which you can find putting in various VEVs and such, is a physical phase of the theory. Thus, decays of B into, for example, charm in a pair of quarks, or B into S in a pair of quarks, could show CP violation if the MSSM contribution is what dominates. Now, where can we see this? Well, you know, the greatest thing to do for CP violation in the B system is go to the B factory and say, what are they going to look at? And B to psi k short is the biggest one. Well, here's the standard model diagram for B to psi k short. This is actually not a particularly suppressed diagram. It's color suppressed, but that's it. Here's the new physics. Well, it's suppressed by what may or may not be a very small loop factor and a charm quark mass, which is small. So this is a huge amplitude. So B to psi k short is not going to show new physics. And this is a general statement about B factory. You don't really look for new physics in B to psi k short CP violation. It's almost impossible. If it was going to show up there, it probably would have showed up somewhere else before. But that doesn't mean there's no place to look. You can also look in things like B to phi k short. Now here's the standard model diagram. This is a penguin. It's highly suppressed by Jim. Here's the new contribution. This is suppressed by the strange quark mass, so this is pretty suppressed too. But it turns out that if I calculate this amplitude and this amplitude roughly, I find that the amplitude for new physics is about 40 times bigger than the standard model amplitude times this factor here. So this is the flavor-changing factor chi, and this is mw squared over the pseudoscalar mass squared. So if I had to put in numbers like a fifth for chi, then I find the pseudoscalar mass is up to 400 GeV can shift the phases observed experimentally by order 1. And if I allow chi of a half, then pseudoscalars up to 600 can do it. Now, the phase you measure in phi k short is often talked about in terms of an angle beta of the unitarity triangles. So you measure beta in psi k short, in phi k short, it's the same beta you measure in psi k short. So if you measure the difference between the CP violating angle in each of these, if it's not zero, then you have evidence for new physics. Now, in 1 year of running, the B factory hopes to be able to measure sine 2 beta phi k short to about 0.6. Now, that's not great after 1 year. I mean, it could be great because psi k short could be 0.7 and phi k short could be minus 1, and they'd be very far apart, and this would be fine. On the other hand, after a couple of years, they expect to do better. They get about 100 of these events a year. And this provides one extra way of looking for this type of CP violation. And you see the numbers we're talking about here, 400, 600 GeV, aren't particularly small numbers. These are very respectable sizes for pseudoscalars. All right, so that stuff on CP violation is very much in the process of being done, and which is why I haven't said more. So let me just go ahead and conclude. We have to remember that even though we typically think of the MSSM as the supersymmetrized standard model, it really is a supersymmetrized two-Higgs doublet standard model. In some limits, this is very important, especially intermediate to large tan beta. The MSSM does allow for flavor changing in CP bilayer neutral Higgs couplings. It's contrary to what had been believed. It does allow for neutral Higgs couplings that aren't proportional to the mass, and therefore some of these invariant decay ratios that people used to think of as being hallmarks of supersymmetry aren't necessarily invariant. What I find fascinating is these effects don't decouple as M2C goes to infinity, so long as I keep the pseudoscalar mass light. So I could put the supersymmetric mass spectrum up 10 TeV, and somehow, if the pseudoscalar is for some reason still light, I can still get order 1 effects. And therefore, we may miss SUSY every other way, but still get it this through this. And then there are a whole host of processes in which this can be looked for. I mean, I've just listed a couple here. By looking at all these various processes and correlating them, hopefully one can actually learn something. And these would be interesting even after supersymmetry is discovered directly, because it's really the only way to get to these diagrams that play such a key role in building guts. Thanks.